April 23, 2019. Location unknown. Day. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is showing his face, and it looks like a bloody death mask. The war of Islam and its followers against the Crusaders and their followers is a long one, he says to the camera. The terrorist leader is surfacing for the first time in 5 years. In an undated video released on the ISIS-run Al-Furqan media network, al-Baghdadi admonishes his followers to fight on. The tips of his gray beard are dyed a bloody crimson. An AK-47 is at his side, locked and loaded. Heavyset, draped in robes, and the type of beige, multi-pocketed vest worn by fishermen, the jihadist sits cross-legged atop ornate cushions, leaning back against a bare white wall. Al-Baghdadi is only 47, but looks a decade older. Three other men sit in the room, their faces concealed. Footnote: the men are essentially props. They are acolytes of al-Baghdadi, but not major players in ISIS. End footnote. For these specially chosen guests, the journey to enter this building and sit in the presence of their supreme leader began with the removal of wristwatches, ensuring that a hidden global positioning system, GPS, cannot be used. Cameras, cell phones, and any other electronics were also confiscated. A blindfold was then placed over their eyes. Each man was led into a van and driven for hours, never given a precise destination. Only upon arrival were the blindfolds removed. Then al-Baghdadi entered the room. When the video session is complete, the three will remain sitting, supervised by armed guards. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi will depart first. The jihadis will be forced to wait until the ISIS leader clears the area. These are extreme measures, but Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi follows strict, paranoid guidelines every day. He well knows he is a hunted man. A single mistake could be the end of him. This is a notable change from the smug al-Baghdadi who addressed hundreds from the pulpit of a Mosul mosque in 2014. 2 years later, in 2016, at the height of his power, the terrorist sultan controlled a swath of land stretching from northern Syria to central Iraq near Baghdad. Millions of people were under his rule, and tens of thousands of soldiers genuflected before him. Now, all that is all gone. ISIS is back where it once was, a guerrilla insurgency waging jihad, one of many such groups in the Middle East. Yet al-Baghdadi fights on. It is known that one of the jihadists' sons, a teenager named Hutaifa al-Badri, was shot dead 1 month ago while fighting for ISIS in Syria. But if that loss devastated al-Baghdadi, he does not show it now. The commander's animated voice betrays no hint of mourning. American intelligence officials will soon discover the reason why. The video's release was delayed to conceal the ISIS killer's whereabouts. The filming actually took place 5 months ago. The bounty on al-Baghdadi's head set by the American government is currently $25 million. His caliphate, as he admits in the video, is now just a brutal memory to the rest of the world. Raqqa, which acted as the ISIS capital city, is back under Syrian government control. But al-Baghdadi makes it known that he is far from finished. ISIS cells are operating in Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. To prove this, an edited clip shows an ISIS attack in Sri Lanka, where militants clad in suicide vests packed with nails killed 250 Christians on Easter Sunday, 2019. As the camera records, al-Baghdadi talks to his three guests. He tells them he does not need the caliphate. He can strike anywhere in the world at any time. The arrogant terrorist has avoided assassination for many years and believes he will never be found. He trusts no one and is comfortable with the elaborate security measures necessary to command his terrorist forces. Al-Baghdadi is confident that one day ISIS will triumph and history will record him as a true world leader, no different than the Muslim clerics who run Iran. When that day comes, he will come out of hiding and be vindicated for all these years of hardship. Our battle today is a war of attrition to harm the enemy, and they should know that jihad will continue until doomsday, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi says confidently, switching his gaze to the camera but not making eye contact with the lens. Al-Baghdadi thinks waiting 5 months to release the video will be enough to cover his tracks. He is wrong. U.S. coalition troops in Iraq and Syria are closing in. And after years of frustration, they finally know where the ISIS leader lives. Half a world away, in a secure facility at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota, American hunters track al-Baghdadi at 30,000 feet over Syria. Two-person teams of Air Force drone pilots sit in air-conditioned cockpits that never leave the ground. Video screens, joysticks, headsets, padded armchairs. These military people are flying remote-controlled unmanned aircraft over Syria from this remote location in the United States. They are young men and women in flight suits who were just children on 9/11. Though these pilots live at home, buy groceries at the base commissary, drive to work each day, and otherwise live a normal life, they go to war in a very high-tech way the instant they settle into their cockpit and speak into their communications devices. Ellsworth is just one of the more than two dozen U.S. military installations around the world that surveil ISIS with Predator and Reaper drones. Years ago, the base's primary arsenal was composed of B-52 Stratofortress bombers, always on standby to repel any global threat. But today's generation of terrorists is not so easily found or defeated as conventional armies of yore. The brutal jihadist killers operate in a shadow world and must be observed by the most clandestine method possible. The deafening roar of a B-52 is replaced in the terror war by the almost total silence of a hovering drone. Known ISIS hideouts are watched from high in the sky without a hint that they are being observed. Recognizing that their nations must also prepare to fight terror attacks at home and abroad, coalition members France, Britain, Australia, and Spain are now training their own flight crews at a similar U.S. base in Nevada, ready to join the fight. The work is primarily tedious, but once in a while, exciting. During a typical 8-hour shift, a drone pilot circles over a target continuously, studying the same vehicles and encampments over and over. The pilots can launch precision hellfire rounds on order, killing killers who pose a threat. Some of the officers who have also flown combat missions in F-16 fighter jets say the stress level is about the same. Most of the time, drone pilots simply wait. One jihadi usually leads them to another. ISIS leadership has learned that telephones, computers, and other electronic communications can reveal locations. Thus, jihadis prefer to speak with their fellow terrorists in person. So it is better to follow the ISIS thugs as they travel the back roads of Iraq and Syria. Drones tail them to every meeting, photographing the faces in attendance and recording the location. This includes Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The confessions of captured terrorist Ismail al-Athawi and the four other top ISIS leaders have yielded several potential places where al-Baghdadi might be hiding. Drones fly above each of these locations for months, the faraway pilots scrutinizing every vehicle entering and exiting the potential lair. Yet for all their scrutiny, the drone pilots have yet to catch even a momentary glimpse of al-Baghdadi. There is a good chance he might not even be in the compound. What the American hunters do see is a facility surrounded by 12-foot-tall dun-colored walls, fruit orchards, a dirt driveway snaking off the paved main highway, and two large buildings with flat roofs, flanked by what appears to be a red water tank. Strangely, there also appears to be an image looking very much like a tennis court outside, though if it is such a thing, it goes unused, as the compound's occupants rarely venture outdoors. The town of Berisha in Syria is in rugged, hilly country, popular with smugglers due to its location 10 miles from the Turkish border. In another time, this was a land of prosperity. Farmers grew olives in large orchards and pressed them for the oil. Wine from the many local vineyards was widely renowned. Stone churches and homes showed this land as a place of prosperity. But that was during the Byzantine era, some 1,500 years ago. The vineyards are now gone. The olive groves remain, though there is little interest in pressing the crop anymore. The Christian churches are rubble. The land around Berisha is sparsely populated, with some residents even living in caves. The drones see all that, but they cannot see inside the buildings. Therefore, they do not know about deadly obstacles, hiding places, the number of women and children, the location of armed guards. Despite that, a plan is slowly taking shape to attack al-Baghdadi's possible hideout. But obviously, it is imperative to confirm he is actually there. 2 bits of luck will soon reveal the truth. For all his secrecy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has a crucial weakness: family. The terrorist is thought to have 4 wives and several children. Family members do not wear blindfolds or discard their cell phones when they rendezvous with the ISIS leader. Thus, those women suspected of attending to al-Baghdadi are easily traced. The CIA begins to focus on one woman in particular who frequently travels outside the compound with a courier serving as her bodyguard. Soon, intelligence agents from Iraq and Kurdish Turkey follow her. Days later, she is placed under arrest. Footnote: the best intelligence comes from Kurdish forces, a rebel group known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, and Iraqi surveillance. All interrogations of ISIS captives take place inside Iraq. End footnote. This is the first stroke of luck. The subsequent interrogation is like any other, starting with endless questioning, sleep deprivation, and a restricted diet. Torture is not used at first, and in the case of this unnamed wife, it is not known whether it becomes necessary. All of that is classified. But it is understood that both the wife and courier begin to talk. The most important question the CIA interrogators want answered: does al-Baghdadi live in the hilltop Berisha compound? Yes. The wife's confession proves that almost everything Ismail al-Athawi told interrogators is correct. The main entry doors are booby-trapped to explode when a hostile force attacks. A network of escape tunnels allows the ISIS leader multiple paths to freedom. Drone surveillance of the fortress is immediately redoubled. Several unmanned aircraft fly simultaneously at different altitudes and send back a comprehensive picture of the compound. The comings and goings in the mountaintop area are intensely scrutinized, particularly the movement of cars and motorcycles. Al-Athawi's statement that al-Baghdadi conceals himself inside minivans carrying loads of vegetables becomes crucial, as such vehicles are regularly seen entering and leaving the compound. The United States requests the assistance of Iraqi and Kurdish intelligence, asking them to provide ground spies who can pinpoint al-Baghdadi's movements whenever he leaves. Then comes the second piece of luck. The man is an Arab. His true identity will never be revealed, for if that ever happened, he would be a dead man. He has decided to betray al-Baghdadi because a loved one has been killed by ISIS, and the Arab wants revenge. But just as important, he wants the $25 million reward for al-Baghdadi's capture or death. The man contacts the CIA through the shadowy world of the global intelligence community. The would-be informant claims al-Baghdadi trusts him and holds him in the highest regard. The anonymous informer wishes to help capture the ISIS leader and is even willing to personally take part in the raid, leading U.S. soldiers through the inside rooms and pointing out tunnel locations. To prove his knowledge, the Arab informs American intelligence that the compound has internet access, paid for in cash to the local service provider at a rate of $8 per month. Al-Baghdadi's personal username is Mirab. His children play online video games. But the CIA wants more. They think this may be a setup. So the informant is asked to do something very unusual. Provide a pair of al-Baghdadi's underwear. He returns with an unwashed, white, baggy garment that extends from the waist to below the knee. That, however, is still not enough for the CIA. Federal agents demand a sample of al-Baghdadi's blood. Amazingly, the informant comes back with a second stolen item, this time a used bandage. Both items match DNA known to have come from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Footnote: al-Baghdadi's DNA was on file with intelligence agencies because he spent a short time in U.S. custody in 2004 prior to the founding of ISIS. A strange ISIS rule forbade the wearing of Western-style underwear, such as briefs or boxers, under penalty of death. ISIS underwear, such as the long undergarment favored by al-Baghdadi, was often brightly colored, a departure from the group's black outer robes. End footnote. So it is that in summer of 2019, the CIA and the American military begin planning a mission to capture the ISIS leader. It will be the most significant raid on a terrorist since Osama bin Laden's demise 8 years before. The comparison is apt. No jihadist since bin Laden has been as successful at remaining hidden while also being in command of his terrorist outfit. Mission planning is divided. Delta Force, Rangers, and Night Stalkers rehearse the combat aspect over and over, even as the intelligence community acquires as much detail as possible through informants, electronic eavesdropping, signal intelligence, and visual information from drones and satellites. It is the military action that will forever be given the spotlight, but intelligence analysis is no less necessary right now. Intelligence personnel follow a proven plan of attack known as Find, Fix, Finish, to guide their investigations. Now, having found and fixed their sights on al-Baghdadi, they seek to finish him. Footnote: Army Rangers are an elite group founded circa 1676 by an English colonist named Colonel Benjamin Church to serve as an irregular fighting force during the early Indian Wars. The Army's Delta Force was founded in 1977 as a small fighting unit tasked to deal specifically with the growing worldwide terror threat. Their maritime equivalent is the Navy's Special Warfare Development Group, a group formerly known as SEAL Team 6. The aerial component, the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, also known as the Night Stalkers, provided helicopters and air crews for both the bin Laden and al-Baghdadi raids. End footnote. Beginning in July, al-Baghdadi appears to take up permanent residence inside the compound. As training for the raid ramps up, it becomes clear that the house outside Berisha will almost surely be the site of the attack. But there are severe problems with this mission. Al-Baghdadi has chosen his hiding place with a masterful tactical eye. There is currently no place on earth so devoted to the terrorist way of life as the land around Berisha. Terrorism has become so ingrained into the region's culture that many young males see this as their only future. Northern Syria is primarily controlled by an al-Qaeda cell made up of rogue ISIS fighters trying to reassemble for another war. In addition, conventional troops of the Syrian and Russian armies stake their own claim to the rugged terrain, living in large military bases and conducting patrols. Their presence is less of a problem in the early days of mission planning because 1,000 U.S. troops are also occupying northern Syria. But just a few weeks before the al-Baghdadi mission is set to launch, President Trump makes a surprise decision to remove those American forces. Officially, there is not even one single American in the region surrounding Barisha. This complicates everything. No longer can U.S. forces approach on the ground. And this presents another problem. Russian MiG fighter jets routinely patrol the airspace on behalf of Syria, eager to shoot down any threats appearing on radar. There is an unwritten agreement between the United States and Russia that drone flights will go unchallenged. But drones are not an invasion force. Thus, the likelihood of United States helicopters bristling with missiles and loaded with elite soldiers flying to the target undetected is non-existent. Delta Force would be quickly shot from the sky. This leaves no doubt. The soldiers must launch from a location outside of Syria using surprise to insert and exfiltrate by helicopter, just like with bin Laden. Time is running out. Anbar province in Iraq has been chosen as ground zero for the raid. Gravel, rock, heat. Not a tree in sight. ISIS knows it well, having captured a town named, coincidentally, al-Baghdadi at the height of the caliphate. During that battle, ISIS laid siege to American and Iraqi troops who were based nearby. Constant mortar fire was leveled by the terrorists, but it caused little damage. The airbase in Anbar is now considered safe enough that President Trump landed here last Christmas to greet troops and have his picture taken with SEAL Team 5. Another plan takes shape. The warriors meet daily for physical training under the hot desert sun and a comprehensive study of their target based on drone and satellite footage. Everything about the raid is top secret, but the soldiers sense something big is about to happen. The operators taking part will not be Navy SEALs, but Army Rangers and Delta Force. This causes tension. There is an inter-service rivalry among elite special forces. Many Army officials believe that the SEALs involved in the bin Laden raid 8 years ago were eager to cash in on their experiences, enjoying a brief moment of fame by writing books and giving talks about the mission. Even fellow Navy SEALs and members of the U.S. intelligence community feel the same. Delta Force vows there will be no such chatter about the hunt for al-Baghdadi. Also, unlike the bin Laden operation, which limited manpower to a dozen SEALs on the ground, the hunt for al-Baghdadi will be a massive attack, utilizing dozens of special forces personnel, helicopters, a fleet of drones, and jet fighters providing air cover. And because the fighting will likely take place indoors, military dogs will also be utilized. Fierce heat in the remote desert location makes each day of preparation a time of great rigor. The elaborate synchronization of so many aircraft and commandos grows more and more fine-tuned with every passing day. By September, as summer temperatures spike even higher, the teams are ready. Now all they need is the order to launch. The warriors gather to select a code name for their upcoming mission. The decision is unanimous. But for now, top secret. Summer is gone. And still no order to attack. It's been months. The Arab spy within the ISIS compound reports that al-Baghdadi is preparing to relocate north to a new house in the town of Jarablus. Luckily, the ISIS leader hasn't moved yet, but the special forces teams are getting restless. He could run any day, meaning this one chance to get him will evaporate. The frustration abates as the decision is made to train at a new site. It's not exactly authorization to go into battle, but it feels as though the teams are getting closer. Men, aircraft, dogs, and munitions are moved to Erbil Air Base in Iraq for training. That facility is only a 70-minute flight to al-Baghdadi's compound. Despite the threat of Russian fighter jets, aerial insertion is the only option. There is no other choice than this extremely risky plan of attack. The Black Hawk and CH-47 helicopters must fly at top speed through hostile Syrian airspace. They are specially equipped to refuel in the air. By hugging the ground, there is hope they can defeat Russian radar and remain unseen. This is the only way in and the only way out. Technically, it is an act of war to enter a foreign country without permission. The pilots are concerned about legalities, but they're even more worried about being blown out of the sky by a Russian Vympel R-73 missile. As the aviators study flight maps, commandos rehearse the insertion again and again in complete secrecy. The Blackhawks will land outside the compound, the Bin Laden raid memorably having shown that attempting to land inside can lead to a vortex ring state crash. Upon touching down, the commandos will blow up the high walls rather than attempt entry through the booby-trapped front door. There will be women and children inside, and likely a small number of armed ISIS bodyguards. The CIA informant will also be inside. Throughout the planning, he has visited with al-Baghdadi a number of times and is trusted enough that he is not blindfolded when led into the compound. He has already provided key details about the interior layout. When the attack comes, he will make himself known and guide the soldiers through the building, maybe taking them directly to al-Baghdadi. Should the mission be a success, the Arab and his family will be secretly relocated to some other part of the world, there to spend the $25 million bounty. Meanwhile, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi waits, apparently thinking he is completely safe. Go time. President Trump grants permission to attack. Pilots and soldiers immediately assemble and load into helicopters. Now it's for real. Finally, they will have their date with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Then, crushing disappointment. The order is soon rescinded, no reason given. Deflated, the teams return to their air-conditioned quarters. Little do they know that high-level negotiations are currently taking place among Washington, Moscow, and the Syrian government. It appears these talks will allow the attack to proceed without any interference from Russian aircraft. But there is a communication breakdown, thus the last-minute decision to scrub. Footnote: the complex negotiations required several adversarial factions to work together with the United States: Russia, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Kurds. End footnote. 1 week later, the order comes again. However, more complications arise, and the teams are again told to stand down. There is grumbling and a frustrating sense that this mission might never happen. Some of the men remember the attempt to rescue Kayla Mueller 5 years ago when U.S. forces arrived just one day after she had been moved to a new location. No one wants that to happen with al-Baghdadi. And then, on October 26th, the green light. The elite commandos and pilots slip into the helicopters, rotors power up, and the dangerous 70-minute ride over Syria begins. The time is just before midnight. 8 helicopters filled with 65 commando warriors lift into the night. Operation Kayla Mueller, as the warriors have named the mission, is about to become real. Chapter 17. October 27th, 2019, Berisha, Syria, 1:10 a.m. ISIS fires first. This is a mistake. The Night Stalkers drop low for the final approach. Black fuselages. Sunday morning, Rustler's Moon beaming pale light, headlights from a lone olive-green minivan on the two-lane road below. The Blackhawks and Chinooks have taken small arms fire on their dash across Syria, but nothing like the precision volleys from automatic weapons now aimed their way from the terrain surrounding al-Baghdadi's suspected compound. Bullets ping off each armored helicopter as muzzle flashes give away the location of ISIS shooters. The soldiers inside are annoyed, but unhurt. The Americans respond. Forward-firing machine guns mounted on each Black Hawk are fully integrated with the aircraft's digital flight controls, automatically calculating range and ballistics. This all happens in less than a second. The Night Stalker pilot blasts the ISIS defenders with 50-caliber Gatling guns and Hydra 70 rockets. Targets neutralized. It is estimated that a dozen or more ISIS fighters outside the compound are killed from the air, but the exact number remains classified. Every effort is being made to avoid civilian casualties. The two pilots are in the unenviable position of making split-second life-or-death decisions. So it is with the minivan. Al-Baghdadi was seen leaving the compound yesterday with his family in such a vehicle. But tonight, although the pilots cannot know this, the ISIS leader has chosen to stay home. Instead, the minivan's three occupants are within 400 meters of the targeted compound. The vehicle is blasted off the road in an instant. Later, the men in the van will say they are not ISIS, just innocent civilians out for a late Saturday night joyride, drinking coffee and eating pumpkin seeds. Two of them, cousins, will eventually die of shrapnel wounds. A third man will live, but one of his hands is severed by a Hydra. Both Blackhawks quickly descend outside the compound. The early morning sky is now alight from the flaming vehicle. A 10-man Delta Force team jumps to the ground, then spreads out. 8 men in one group, just 2 in the other. The soldiers walk toward the dwelling with weapons already in firing mode. From Iraq, Mission Control speaks into their earpieces, reporting that drone footage shows no sign of guards. The night is active. The air is full of 6 Chinook helicopters carrying reinforcements, a phalanx of drones, and a number of supersonic fighter jets keeping watch in the upper atmosphere. Delta Force arrives at the wall, then attaches explosives to the side at a spot precisely 4 feet off the ground. Each man steps away and turns his back to shield himself from the blast. The surgical detonation explodes as planned. A loud boom and percussive shockwave ensue. Rubble flies into the compound. A second hole is quickly blasted in another section. The team does not wait for the smoke to clear, advancing forward quickly. The Delta Force team are identically clad. Black helmet, night vision goggles, body armor, M4 assault rifle, and a Glock 9mm pistol on the hip. Each soldier carries a knife of his own choosing. In addition, they are armed with fragmentation hand grenades as well as extra clips of ammunition. The second Blackhawk lands, dropping off another team and Conan, a Belgian Malinois military dog named after the late-night television host. He is a 4-year veteran with 50 missions to his credit. As with the Bin Laden raid, the dog will be used to pursue any fleeing terrorist and to intimidate Muslims who are generally afraid of dogs. Now the Delta teams prepare to enter the buildings thought to house Al-Baghdadi and his family. The reckoning is here. Approximately 10 minutes after landing, a Delta Force soldier calls out in Arabic, requesting that Al-Baghdadi surrender. Moments pass, but the team is not in a hurry. They know air and ground is totally controlled by U.S. forces. What they don't know is where the ISIS leader is located. Suddenly, 11 children under the age of 12 and 2 women step into the courtyard. They are immediately searched for weapons, especially suicide vests, then led into a waiting helicopter. But not before they reveal that Al-Baghdadi is not alone in the compound. There are other children, 4 more women, and at least 4 ISIS fighters. Footnote. The names of the 13 people who surrendered at the onset of the raid are still confidential, but they are thought to be the wives and children of the ISIS terrorists protecting Al-Baghdadi. None of them accompanied U.S. soldiers back to the base at the end of the raid. Instead, they were released to local Syrian officials. End footnote. Once the 13 children and women are off the premises, Delta Force soldiers move smoothly across the hard dirt between the houses. As drones watch overhead, the voice of their far-off mission commander confirms that no one has escaped from either building. The final assault is ready. 6,000 miles away in the White House Situation Room, President Donald Trump watches the mission unfold in real time on large monitors. Also in the room are Vice President Mike Pence, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, and General Mark Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A tangle of secure phone lines covers the large rectangular conference table. Earlier today, after authorizing the mission, the president played golf with Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball. Tonight is Game 4 of the World Series, and Mr. Trump took great pains not to deviate from his long-prepared schedule. Everything must look normal. By 5 p.m. Washington time, just as the first helicopters are leaving for the al-Baghdadi compound, the president has changed into a dark blue suit and light blue tie to watch the raid. This is a signature moment in the war on terror. The Trump administration has taken a hard line on ISIS, but Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has remained at large for the 3 years Mr. Trump has been in office, confounding all efforts to take him into custody. The mood in the Situation Room is tense, all present hoping that the terrorist does not find a way to escape one more time. Meantime, things are moving fast inside the hideout. Delta Force has swarmed both houses. The buildings are not large, and the informant has already disclosed the layout, right down to the location of the bathrooms and bedrooms. The Arab himself is inside al-Baghdadi's residence. Shouting and screaming in English and Arabic, he makes himself known to the soldiers. His photograph has been shown to Delta Force, who immediately confirm his identity. With the Arab's guidance, U.S. troops go from room to room in rapid fashion. The women are captured first. Four were sleeping but were awakened by the explosions. Quickly, they rose and dressed themselves in long black robes and head coverings. Soldiers burst into their room and, in Arabic, order the women to put their hands in the air. This is to make it impossible for them to ignite suicide vests. The women refuse. And they are wearing suicide vests. Among these women are two of al-Baghdadi's wives. A standoff ensues. Delta Force prefers to arrest the women, not kill them. Mission details remain classified, and what happens next still has not been revealed. But the authors of this book can confirm at least one of the women reaches down to trigger the explosives strapped to her body. There is no hesitation. All four are shot in the head and die instantly. To shoot them in the torso would have detonated the vests. In another part of the compound, two ISIS fighters, men, are also shot dead trying to detonate explosives. Delta Force is too quick for them, and the terrorists are eliminated. The death toll is now 6. But where is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? Conan the dog is brought forward to find him. Working with the Arab, the Americans discover the compound escape tunnels deep below the buildings. There, another ISIS terrorist surrenders. Now it's just al-Baghdadi at large. The ISIS leader is desperately trying to flee underground. Conan chases him down a tunnel. Delta Force suspects that the ISIS leader may be wearing a suicide vest, so the soldiers keep their distance. What they don't know is that the cowardly al-Baghdadi has two small children with him. In the distance, voices of the frightened kids echo down the enclosure. And then comes a defiant taunt in Arabic, stating that the great Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi will never be taken alive. The man who is hiding behind his children is somehow portraying himself as special. The tunnel is primitive, with many exposed electrical fixtures. As Conan goes farther into the shaft, barking to alert the soldiers of his progress, the dog brushes up against a live wire. Badly shocked and gravely wounded, Conan is rushed back to a helicopter for medical assistance. Footnote: Conan survives the injury and is present at a White House ceremony 1 month later to celebrate the successful mission. Early media reports suggested Conan was female, but the Belgian company that performed his initial training later confirmed the dog is male. The 7-year-old Conan answers to commands in German, not English. He is still on active duty as of this writing. End footnote. Al-Baghdadi continues to taunt the Americans, hoping to draw them into a death trap. But Delta Force is above all disciplined, and the warriors refuse to be lured. By this time, the Arab has pinpointed the tunnel's exit for the American troops, and soldiers have blocked any escape. The tunnel is now a dead end. An American calls out to al-Baghdadi in Arabic, demanding he release the children. At first, nothing happens. Unbeknownst to Delta Force, the coward Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has now pulled his 2 young children to his side. Neither is over the age of 10. The terrorist grips them tightly, feeling the fear in their young bodies. Al-Baghdadi finds the detonator switch attached to his suicide vest, then presses down hard with his right thumb. Footnote: the last moments of al-Baghdadi and his children were put together by forensic experts. The terrorist was right-handed. End footnote. The explosion kills the villain and his children instantly. The tunnel collapses, crushing the corpses. All 3 bodies are severed into pieces, arms, legs, and torsos poking from the rubble. Al-Baghdadi's head remains intact, which will allow quick facial recognition of the body. But not until his identity is proven through DNA testing can Delta Force be completely sure they got their man. The killer Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi goes out in a despicable way, murdering his own offspring. The names, ages, and genders of the children remain classified to this day. Delta Force works quickly, lifting rocks and mortar in the narrow space to extricate the bodies in order to confirm the terrorist's death. Back in Washington, D.C., the president and his advisors cannot see the real-time fate of al-Baghdadi. Drones can only show open space. The Situation Room is very quiet. Mr. Trump believes the mission has been a success, and his speechwriters are already preparing remarks. But no one is celebrating. The faces of the president and his top officials are grim as they await the special code word confirming al-Baghdadi's death. The minutes tick past. No one leaves the room. On the video screens, images of dozens of U.S. troops can be seen entering the 2 buildings to scavenge for intelligence, cell phones, laptops, flash drives, and whatever documents they come across. No bit of information is too trivial. The Army Rangers and Delta Force are in no hurry to complete their task, taking as much time as they need to find every last bit of data on the scene. Each man wears a body camera, but images from inside the building are not transmitted on the live feed. Footnote: American Special Forces once wore helmet cameras but switched to body cameras. Helmet cameras transmitted video in real time, while body cams record images for downloading after the mission is complete. The reason for the switch was the confusing second-guessing from high-level officials watching from a remote location that often took place while a mission was underway. End footnote. Upon leaving, soldiers can be seen carrying not just the information cache, but also body bags to the helicopters. Al-Baghdadi, his wives, and his children will be buried at sea within the next 24 hours. The bin Laden ritual repeated again. Also at the compound are special medical technicians who are in the process of verifying DNA from al-Baghdadi's torn-up body. The techs flew to the area with samples of the ISIS leader's DNA in hand. The body is in pieces, each of which is carried from the tunnel for testing and burial. The jubilation over the ISIS leader's death is tempered by the reality that this could have been a body double. It takes 15 minutes for scientific confirmation to come through. Finally, they have their proof. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is in hell. It is 2:15 a.m. in Berisha, 7:15 p.m. in Washington. The long-awaited code word is transmitted. Jackpot. Got him. 100% confidence. 1 hour later, as the 8 helicopters containing the soldiers depart the compound for the 70-minute flight back to Iraq, the night is quiet, though only for a short time. In order that this area not become an ISIS shrine, it must no longer exist. F-15 Strike Eagle fighter jets and Reaper drones fire on the site, leveling everything. This is no simple rocket attack, but rather a pulverizing combination of Hellfire and standoff missiles, as well as laser-guided bombs. Nothing is left of the evil hiding place. Footnote: no American casualties resulted from the raid. An estimated 45 to 60 men took part. All the combatants and pilots received commendations, but secretly, as publicizing their identities would put them at risk. End footnote. In Washington, D.C., President Donald Trump once again turns to Twitter to communicate with the world. "Something very big has just happened," he tweets at 9:23 p.m. "A press conference will be coming soon," he promises. Intense and elated, Mr. Trump ignores the speech his writers are working on. He prefers to tell the story in his own words, which he will do, but on his own timetable. Chapter 18. October 27, 2019, Washington, D.C., morning. The President of the United States is feeling a surge of satisfaction. "Last night, the United States brought the world's terrorist leader to justice." Speaking in the White House diplomatic reception room, Donald Trump wears a dark suit and red tie. His voice is somber. Reporters and television cameras fill the spacious oval room. This morning's address has been delayed 30 minutes so the president can put final touches on his speech. "Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead." This accomplishment is sorely needed good news for the Trump administration. The president is on the verge of being impeached for allegedly soliciting foreign assistance from Ukraine in his re-election bid. Trump's relationship with Russian leader Vladimir Putin is the subject of another controversy. And Turkish President Recep Erdogan boldly ordered President Trump to remove American troops from northern Syria earlier this month, a demand with which the usually defiant U.S. president complied. So just as the Osama bin Laden commando operation boosted the Obama administration, President Trump hopes that the al-Baghdadi raid will do the same for him. He chose not to break the news last night, knowing many Americans would be distracted on a Saturday. Instead, he has chosen Sunday morning, a time when the nation tunes in for morning network news shows as well as football pregame programs. Donald Trump also hopes to downplay his predecessor's bin Laden accomplishment, stating that al-Baghdadi was a much bigger threat. Knowing the power of visual imagery, the president has ordered that a photo be released of himself and his top officials taken in the Situation Room shortly after the raid. For Donald Trump, the death of al-Baghdadi is a personal triumph. He has long loathed all the jihadists. He still remembers 9/11 vividly. "The United States has been searching for Baghdadi for many years. Capturing or killing Baghdadi has been the top national security priority of my administration. U.S. Special Operations Forces executed a dangerous and daring nighttime raid in northwestern Syria and accomplished their mission in grand style," the president says. "The U.S. personnel were incredible. I got to watch much of it. No personnel were lost in the operation, while a large number of Baghdadi's fighters and companions were killed with him. He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way. Mr. Trump speaks for 10 minutes, his voice rising as his contempt for al-Baghdadi grows more theatrical. Last night was a great night for the United States and for the world. A brutal killer, one who has caused so much hardship and death, has violently been eliminated. He will never again harm another innocent man, woman, or child. He died like a dog. He died like a coward. The world is now a much safer place. With that, the scripted speech is over. When President Obama announced the bin Laden killing, he gave a simple address to the nation, then turned around and departed. But Donald Trump owns the airwaves right now. America is watching. This opportunity cannot be ignored. So the president begins taking questions. As Commander-in-Chief, a role Donald Trump relishes, he has the authority to frame the anti-terror action in Syria any way he wants. From the first day I came to office, and now we're getting close to 3 years, I would say, "Where's al-Baghdadi? I want al-Baghdadi." And we would kill terrorist leaders, but they were names I never heard of. They were names that weren't recognizable, and they weren't the big names. Some good ones, some important ones, but they weren't the big names. I kept saying, "Where's al-Baghdadi?" And a couple of weeks ago, they were able to scope him out. And that's why he died like a dog. He died like a coward. He was whimpering, screaming, and crying. And frankly, I think it's something that should be brought out so that his followers and all of these young kids that want to leave various countries, including the United States, they should see how he died. He didn't die a hero. He died a coward, crying, whimpering, screaming, and bringing 3 kids with him to die a certain death. And he knew the tunnel had no end. I mean, it was a closed end. They call it a closed end tunnel. Not a good place to be. The number of children killed and the type of tunnel are inaccurate, but the president's message is clear. He believes al-Baghdadi is a more important target than Osama bin Laden, so he continues to put forth that narrative. "Was he being chased?" a reporter asks, referring to al-Baghdadi. "These people, they were moving. They were chasing, yeah. They were chasing. But again, because of the suicide vest, you can't get too close," answers the president. "Again, one of the reasons with the wives is if they have a suicide vest, you know, you have to be very, very careful. These vests are brutal. Brutal. And they go for a long distance." The reporter follows up. "Have you spoken or will you speak to the families like the Foley family?" "I'm calling the families now. It will be a pleasure to do that. The Foley family, who I know. We'll be calling Kayla's family. What he did to her was incredible. It's a well-known story, and I'm not going to say it, but you know that. He kept her in captivity for a long period of time. He kept her in his captivity, his personal captivity. She was a beautiful woman, beautiful young woman, helped people. She was there to help people. And he saw her, and he thought she was beautiful, and he brought her into captivity for a long period of time, and then he killed her. He was an animal." With the "hate Trump" American media dominant, the speech, as well as the Q&A, is almost instantly denigrated. The episode became another pointed illustration of the perils of the president's confrontational style of governing and the bitter partisanship into which the U.S. has descended, notes the British Broadcasting Corporation. It stood in contrast to Barack Obama's solemn evening announcement of Osama bin Laden's death, although that should not be surprising at this point. Mr. Trump has said that his conduct is modern-day presidential, and his blunt, frequently casual language is part of that package. Dozens of newspapers compare the two speeches, many preferring Obama's low-key approach to Trump's taunting. The New York Times takes a different angle, speaking to high-level officials who fear President Trump's rhetoric will have a long-term negative effect on the terror war. The newspaper quotes Juliette Kayyem, a former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama. "In other words, the impact of his gloating is more harmful to us and takes a winning moment that our allies needed and our enemies should fear and turns it into a question of credibility. Lost in the partisan coverage of al-Baghdadi's demise is an objective look at geopolitics with ISIS weakened. Also missing, an analysis of the methodical effectiveness of the American military and intelligence apparatus. Neither President Obama nor his predecessor, President George W. Bush, issues a statement about the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. It is widely known that both men despise Donald Trump. The global response to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's death, however, is overwhelmingly positive. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace notes that the world will not miss al-Baghdadi. French President Emmanuel Macron notes that the fight must continue. Al-Baghdadi's death is a hard blow against Islamic State, but it is just a stage. With our partners in the international coalition, the fight continues to finally defeat this terrorist organization. It is our priority in the Middle East. Even Russia applauds the death of the ISIS leader. In Arizona, Kayla Mueller's parents finally know that their daughter's killer has been brought to justice. "I'm glad that evil person is gone," Mueller's father says on NBC's Today show. "If you were a parent and this man did what he did to Kayla to your child and then they got him, how would you feel?" "That was just an amazing gift for Kayla," her mother adds. "I know Kayla. Kayla would say this was for all of us. This is for all the hostages." But in Iran, General Qasem Soleimani is not impressed. The general directs his Secretary of Information to tweet, "Not a big deal. You just killed your creature," implying that the United States is the reason ISIS exists in the first place. As for the terrorist organization itself, it refuses to even acknowledge that al-Baghdadi is dead. However, 2 months after the raid, the West African branch of ISIS, a group of thugs and rapists known as Boko Haram, kills 11 Christian hostages, claiming their executions are revenge for the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. President Trump basks in the public praise, but seethes over some media criticism. Game 5 of the World Series is being played in Nationals Park, a stadium not far from the White House. In his youth, the president was a decent ballplayer and once even pondered making the game his profession. He now sits in a luxury box with his wife Melania and several Republican dignitaries. Red, white, and blue bunting lines the railings. The spectators largely wear red and white, the colors of the Washington team. A stadium camera pans over the crowd, settling on the face of Mr. Trump. Even at a ball game, he wears a coat and tie. Many in the stadium applaud enthusiastically at the sight of the president. Patriotism is in the air tonight, and the killing of al-Baghdadi elicits chants of USA, USA. Then comes some boos. During their terms in office, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, and both Bushes were booed while attending baseball games. Such is the fickle nature of the American populace. A chant soon arises from the crowd, loud enough to be heard clearly over the buzz of a packed stadium. These are words referring to Donald Trump's ongoing impeachment issues, a taunt that he originated against political rival Hillary Clinton during the 2016 presidential race. "Lock him up!" A short while later, the president and his wife leave the stadium before the game is over. The takedown of al-Baghdadi generally helps the Trump administration, but it is not a complete victory. The bitter partisanship that has consumed America soon blocks out the ISIS raid. The Democratic Party is invested in playing down all accomplishments of Donald Trump's, but the truth is that ISIS has been severely degraded and is no longer the top terror threat against America. That description now belongs to Iran and its ferocious military leader, General Qasem Soleimani. President Trump knows this, and because of Soleimani's public insults, America's leader has another score to settle. And the endgame is now underway. Chapter 19. October 27, 2019. Somewhere in Syria. Evening. U.S. intelligence presses its advantage against ISIS, but there is someone looking over the shoulder of the Americans. 6,000 miles from Washington, on the night of World Series Game 5, the next potential leader of ISIS rides inside an empty gasoline tanker truck. He is mourning the death of al-Baghdadi, but there is nothing that can be done. The Islamic State must carry on. The wheels of transition are already in motion. In accordance with the Quran, a group known as the Majlis Ashura, or simply the Shura Council, will soon gather in a secret location to vote for a new ISIS leader. These men are advisors to the caliph. The size of the group varies, but right now the council numbers almost 30. They consider themselves deeply religious, but also hyper-political, with many former members of the Ba'ath Party dedicated to unifying the Middle East into a single Islamic state. And like al-Baghdadi, a number of these men were held in U.S. custody at a prison known as Camp Buka during the American invasion of Iraq. The man riding in the tanker is confident he will be chosen to lead the militant group. Abu Hassan al-Muhajir has been the official ISIS spokesman for the last 5 years. He has risen through the ranks, devoting his life to the cause. Al-Baghdadi was a friend and mentor to him, and it is from the departed terrorist that al-Muhajir learned how to rule. Above all, al-Baghdadi was adept at demanding loyalty from the many factions within the Islamic State. Al-Muhajir must do the same. Like the deceased al-Baghdadi, the spokesman is never seen in public. Very little is known about